chapter 1. Before we get into the heart of the chapter, I just wanted to put some facts out there. 42% of all corporate projects are abandoned before completion. About 53% of government projects are abandoned before completion. Many systems that are not abandoned are late, cost more, and have fewer features. Top companies all have a history of failure. Microsoft, GE, IBM, Boeing, etc. Therefore, failure is across the board. No company is really immune from failure. There is also no silver bullet that makes a company immune from IS failure. And there are no silver bullets in this class, so don't come expect any silver bullets. The question then becomes, how do we define IS failure? What are some possible definitions of information system failure? Well, system fails for a number of reasons. One reason is the requirements are not met. The system may cost too much, and as a result, it is abandoned. Systems may take too long, and as a result, they are abandoned. A system may be developed, meet all of the expectations. But if the system is not used, then it's considered a failure. Systems could be developed, meet the expectations once again, but it becomes outdated after it is developed. So what really constitutes or contributes to IS failure? Well, a lack of understanding regarding the business needs, poor analysis, for example, incomplete requirements, missing requirements, etc. Political system that someone developed as a pet project, maybe to give them a promotion. Incompatibility with existing systems is another reason for failure. Poor timing is another reason. Therefore, what can we do to improve the success of new systems? One way to increase the success of new projects and systems is to use a method. Success hinges on three factors: the use of a method, techniques, and tools. So the question then becomes, what is a method or methodology? A methodology really refers to more than a simple set of methods. Rather, it refers to the rationale and the philosophy of certain assumptions that underlie a particular study. This is why scholarly literature often includes a section on the methodology of the researchers used for a particular study. A technique, however, is really a procedure used to accomplish a specific activity or task. For example, the task of doing activity diagramming or the task of doing analysis. Tools and technology are self-explanatory. For example, Visio would be considered a tool. So let's talk about the evolution of system development. In the early part of the development of the field of information systems, system development was very unstructured. And for those who may be familiar, back in those days, we used to use a lot of go-to statements in the programming code. And by the time you get to the fifth go-to, one gets confused as to where to go next. So it was very unstructured. However, in the 70s, researchers came up with an idea, and it was referred to as structured programming. And in structured programming, they added a number of control structures like do while, do until, if then else, case statements, etc. These provide structure to the programming effort and to the development effort. Then in the early 70s also came the development of the first method, which was known as the waterfall method. So you're going to hear me use a term sometimes called the SDLC, which stands for System Development Life Cycle. The System Development Life Cycle is really a set of life cycles one of which is the waterfall method, and there are other life cycles that fall under the auspices of rapid application development, parallel development, etc., agile development, extreme programming. These are all methods. However, the first one and the most used one is the system development life cycle, known as the waterfall method. So what we're going to do now, we spend some time talking about the waterfall method, because the waterfall method is like the godfather or the mother of all methodologies. And what you'll see is that the other methodologies are really variations of the system development life cycle, i.e. the waterfall method. So the waterfall method is nothing more than a set of steps that an analyst would use to bring about the delivery of a new information system. The waterfall method actually has four steps or stages. It starts out with planning, analysis, design, and implementation. What we're going to do now is spend some time talking about what is done in the planning phase, which is stage one or step one of the system development life cycle. Every project has to go through the planning phase. As a matter of fact, every project has to go through all four phases. The first phase, as we said, is the planning stage. So in the planning stage, we're trying to get a better understanding of what really is the problem. When users come and indicate that there is a problem, sometimes that is not really the problem. That may be a symptom of the problem. And as the analyst, we have an expectation and an obligation to figure out what the problem really is. So we go to discover the root of the problem. We're also trying to find out what is the objective of developing the new system. Why should the system be built? Who are we building it for? How is it going to be used? These are important questions to understand in the planning phase. Projects usually get started because someone discovered a problem or see an opportunity to build a new system. And so a document is usually required. This document is known as the system request. So the user is actually requesting a system. And in most companies, this is the formal process. So the system request is a document, which is really a brief summary of a business problem or opportunity, how the system will satisfy the need or solve the problem, and the benefits, potential benefits that the system should deliver to the company that is spending the money to develop this particular system. So the system request would be forwarded to a team or a group that would investigate and look at the system request and make a determination as to whether or not the company ought to spend money to bring about this new system. Some systems get past the system request stage, and other systems die and never get past the system request investigation. The next step then is to do a feasibility study. So the assumption here is that the system request was considered and there is now a mandate to move to the next stage. The next stage is known as the feasibility study. And the feasibility study would investigate whether or not this system is feasible. The feasibility study involved three aspects. Technical feasibility, which has to do with, do we have the technical whereabouts to build the system? Economic feasibility has to do with whether the company could afford at this point in time to build the system. And organizational feasibility has to do with, if we do build the system, will the users use it? For the feasibility to be positive, it means that all three of these aspects should be acceptable. Now, if the project get past the feasibility stage, then it actually now becomes a living project. Prior to the feasibility stage, we were just looking at its potential and it was not considered a project. But once it gets past the feasibility stage, it is now considered a project, in the sense that we now assign a project manager, we assign resources and people, etc., and now we have a live and living project. prior to that, we were exploring whether or not we want to undertake a project. The next stage of the system development life cycle is analysis. Most system development projects actually work on existing systems, not new systems. Most companies have embedded systems which have to be maintained. So a lot of the work that we do in the field is trying to improve existing systems as opposed to developing new systems. Therefore, quite often when we perform analysis, we're actually trying to understand the existing system, the current systems. We're trying to understand its problems, its limitations, its strengths. By understanding its strengths and weaknesses, we're then in a much better position to fix and improve what is wrong with the existing system. In the analysis phase, we also look at requirements. We have to determine what requirements the system will need in order for it to function and satisfy users. This may involve developing business models like activity modeling, use case modeling. Therefore, some of the techniques that we're going to learn in the book, activity modeling, use case modeling, are actually used as part of the analysis. For example, when the system analyst develops an activity model, the analyst is actually learning about the business and what goes on in the department or the function. Bear in mind that the analyst actually comes from IT and knows very little about what's happening in the function. So the process of undertaking the development of an activity model is a learning experience for the analyst. So analysis is really about understanding what's going on in the function, and the creation of these models is a major part of this learning process. Now, at the end of the analysis phase, a document is created. This document is known as a system proposal. And the system proposal includes all the work we've done before, the work we've done in planning, and the work we've just accomplished in analysis. And this document serves to represent what has been developed so far about the project. And it would be live and living in the sense that it would be modified going forward as we add and subtract elements to the project. So the system proposal actually moves along with the project and reflects what has been done. So it's not a one-time document. It actually follows the project through to the end. The third stage of the system development life cycle is design. Design deals with things like hardware. What hardware are we going to use? What software are we going to use for the new system? What sort of networking infrastructure? Systems often have to communicate with other existing systems. We even have to think about new systems. How will the system we're going to develop will, in the future, communicate with new systems that the company might be considering? The graphical user interface is also part of the design. So there are a number of things that we ought to consider in the design. So there is a design strategy that we have to consider. And the design strategy has to do with, are we going to build it ourselves? If we're going to build it in-house, then that is considered to be insourcing. If we're going to build it outside, then we consider it to be outsourcing, where a third party is involved. We could also buy the product off the shelf and implement it. That's another design strategy. We could choose to buy it off the shelf and do some custom. But the three basic strategies are to build it inside or in-house, insourcing, have a third party do the work, which is outsourcing, and the last one is to pretty much buy the product off the shelf, whether you implement it as is or make minor changes, which we call customizing. What are some of the things that we design? Well, as I said earlier, we design the graphical user interface, databases, files and tables, programs or classes. We design farms, we design reports, we design the infrastructure. We even design test scripts to test the system after it is implemented. The last phase of the system development life cycle, i.e. in this case the waterfall method, is implementation. Implementation means to build. So we have to build some of the things that we now created in design. So if we design graphical user interfaces, we now have to build them. If we design classes and programs, we now have to build them. If we design forms and reports, we now have to build them. Once the system is built, we have to test it to make sure it works, make sure it satisfies the requirements, make sure that it satisfies users, etc. If the tests go as planned and are successful, then we could hand over the new system to the users. This process is known as conversion. So to hand over the new system to the users, we have to select a conversion strategy. The conversion strategy is really an approach for how do we go about handing it over to the user. And there are several approaches. These are discussed in more detail in the last chapter in the book. But some of the conversion strategies include parallel conversion, phased conversion, direct conversion, etc. Once the system is handed over, the next thing we have to focus on is training and support for users. You just can't hand over a new system to the users and expect them to know how to use it. If you do that, you're setting yourself up for failure. So one of the things we do, and a very important step, is to make sure that we have sufficient support and training for users during the implementation process and after the implementation. Because even after the implementation, users are still going to have issues and problems that they need help with. And if you don't provide it, then they would stop using the system, and by definition, that becomes a system failure. Then the last thing we do in implementation is what we call post-implementation. Some people refer to it as maintenance. So once the system is up and developed and running, satisfying users at the moment, the next thing we have to do is maintenance. It's like taking your car to the mechanic shop every 3 months or 6 months to make sure it's running well, servicing it, etc. We do the same things here. We even try to improve it, adding features that maybe we didn't get a chance to implement due to the schedule, or maybe we discovered new features based on what's going on in the environment, what's going on in the company, and this is a good time to add and subtract features to the existing system in an attempt to improve it. Now, methods could be broken down into different categories. For example, process-centered methods like use case diagrams, activity diagrams, data flow diagrams. These are used to model the business process or business activities. And this is mostly what we have in the text. We have process-centered methods, often used in systems analysis and design. Then we have data-centered methods, which you would find in a database course. We have object-oriented methods, which we are using here in the form of UML. We also have structured design methods, which were developed in the early 70s. And the classic example of that is the waterfall method. Now, the waterfall method, even though it's very well used, like every method, has limitations. One of the primary limitations of the waterfall method is that it takes too long, and sometimes users are not heavily involved, especially in the middle to later stages of the project. As a result, some users suffer from what is known as alienation, not being involved sufficiently through the entire system development lifecycle. Now, bear in mind that there are clearly advantages to using the waterfall method. It provides structure and discipline, highly appropriate for many projects, especially large, medium-sized projects. They need discipline and structure, and the waterfall method does an excellent job of that. But as I said earlier, it does have its limitations, like all methods. Takes long to develop, doesn't involve users as it should. You have to specify everything on paper before you start the implementation phase. So as a result of that, companies, researchers wanted to develop new methods to see if they could overcome some of the limitations of the waterfall method. As a result, several different types of method came into being. One type discussed in the book is RAD, Rapid Application Design. And rapid application design is an attempt to bring systems to fruition in a short time, hence the word rapid. How can we get it done as soon as possible? So in this category, we have several methods. One is known as JAD, Joint Application Design. JAD is a process used to elicit requirements. Actually, we used to use it at work. And the way we approach it at work is that we actually set up a room with computers and we have users come and sit at the computer. And we usually try to get them for an extended period of time, for the whole day, several days, a week. And we would just go through the process of eliciting requirements and developing the diagrams needed for the new system. Now, in order to facilitate JAD, you're going to need a facilitator who runs the sessions. So the facilitator would ask questions, pose questions, tease out requirements, resolve conflict, set up the schedule and the agenda items for each meeting. And then you need a scribe to take notes. The primary purpose of JAD is really to shorten the requirements gathering phase by reducing the number of individual interviewing sessions. Prior to JAD, if you had 20 people that you wanted to interview, that meant at least 20 interviews. Of course, there were follow-up interviews. And that takes a long time, having to work around people's schedule. But if you could get them into a room all at the same time, then you accomplish, you know, what would have taken months in a matter of days. Another joint application, another RAD methodology is what is known as 4GL, which stands for fourth generation language. The best known example of a fourth generation language is SQL or SQL that is used for database. It's amazing what you could accomplish using 4GL. When you write one or two lines of 4GL, you could accomplish a lot of work. If you had to write the same program using a first generation or second or third generation language, it would require a lot more work. And the reason why 4GL is so powerful is because 4GL is actually built or using, you know, the engine of third generation languages. So behind the scene, third generation languages are really doing a lot of the work, but you don't have to worry about that because you're not using the third generation language, you're actually using the fourth generation language. But underneath the code is the, you know, third generation language that's really accomplishing the work for you. But for those who have worked in SQL and have used other programming languages, you would realize that SQL, the fourth generation language, you know, you could accomplish a lot more work. It's easier to work with in terms of programming a system in 4GL as opposed to a lower level language. Then of course we have case tools. Case tools are really technologies that are used to aid the development process. One of the tools that we use in this class is Visio. It's a very well-known and common tool used in industry. But there are other tools like Visible Analyst, Rational Rows. Well, it used to be called Rational Rows. It's now called Rational Software Architect. There's also the Rational Software Modeler. These are two tools that you get from IBM. And there are others. Another approach on the RAD is known as phased development. Phased development is where you break the system up into several sequential versions. I call it the Microsoft strategy. You know, you develop a system, it may not have all the bells and whistles, and then you put it out there. And then every 6 months, a year, you add additional features or new features to it, and you keep it live and also, you know, extend its life by adding new features every so often to the system. A popular approach under the RAD is a method known as prototyping, sometimes known as the iterative approach. are the non-sequential approach. Very different approach from using the waterfall method, which is very structured. Prototyping is not structured. It's a non-linear approach where the analyst is in several phases at the same time. For example, in the waterfall method, you have to start with planning. When planning is done, you then move to design. When design is done, you then move to implementation, etc. So you go through the four steps: planning, analysis, design, and implementation. In prototyping, that sequential approach kind of is thrown out of the window. So let me give you an example of how prototyping works. A user comes to me, says, I have a problem. I investigate the problem. I sit with the user. I get a quick and dirty understanding of what the user wants. I go back and let's suppose I decided to develop a little access database. So based on my initial discussion, meeting with the user, I come up with a kind of rough design. Then I meet with the user a day or two later and I say, here's what I have. Tell me what you think. And I listen, I understand, and I go back and I make changes. I bring it to the user. They tell me what are the strengths, weaknesses, what's missing, what they would like to have, etc. But what's happening in these meetings is that every time I sit with the user, I'm learning a lot about the system. But what I'm learning may be coming from several phases. I may be still in the planning phase because I don't have a true picture of what the application looks like. I'm also in the analysis phase because I'm still trying to understand what are all of the requirements. And I'm still trying to design the application because it's still incomplete, so I'm still looking at and trying to understand the design aspects. And I'm at the same time building, so I'm in the implementation phase. So when I sit with the user, I'm pretty much in all phases at any point in time. I'm still trying to understand the planning aspects, analysis, design, and implementation. That's what makes prototyping non-linear. So it's a very ad hoc approach, is one way you could describe it. Now, in the waterfall method, there is a process called the sign-off process. And how this works is that at the end of each stage in the waterfall method, the person who's spending the money, the sponsor, has to sign a document. It's called the sign-off process. And what he's saying, the symbolism of that sign-off process, is to indicate that a particular phase is now complete and we are now committed to the next phase. In prototyping, there is no sign-off process because it is so unstructured that there is no sign-off that could be achieved. We are doing multiple things all at the same time. Clearly, while prototyping has advantages in terms of bringing systems to life in a short period of time, it clearly has disadvantages. As you can see, it's very unstructured, it's ad hoc. An ad hoc approach is difficult to manage. Which means then that if you had a large project, you couldn't use prototyping. It would be highly inappropriate, it would be a poor choice. But if you had a small project, it would be highly appropriate. Secondly, one advantage of prototyping is also that it gets the user involved from beginning to end, unlike the waterfall method. A disadvantage, however, another disadvantage is that it is very easy to be pressured into delivering the system before it is complete because the user realized the benefit of the prototype and would like to have it now as opposed to later. But the prototype is incomplete, so you don't want to deliver the project in its incomplete form, otherwise it would come back to haunt you because it would break down. It's not complete. It's not ready to be delivered. So you have to be able to resist and say no. Another method under the RAD is a common development method known as Agile. Agile, like prototyping, is an attempt to get systems developed quickly. So they try to minimize the planning, analysis, and design stages and move very quickly into implementation. While there is some advantage to doing that, and the advantage primarily is to bring system to life quickly, there are clearly some disadvantages. Because when you don't understand the system well enough, you haven't spent time planning and analyzing and designing it, then you end up in implementation having to spend a lot of time to correct problems and issues that you never really considered. So once again, there are advantages and disadvantages to these methods. in the book there is a table that talks about how do you choose a particular method. This is on page 16, figure 1-8. The table looks a bit complicated, but I'll break it down for you very simply in terms of how do you pick a method. If the project is large and complicated, then you need structure in order to manage and control the project. Large, complicated projects need structure. The technique or the method that is most appropriate for large, complicated projects is the waterfall method. It brings structure, it brings discipline. If you have a small project, especially where the requirements are not clear, then prototyping is an excellent approach, because the prototyping approach helps you to sit down with the user and over time elicit the requirements that may not be clear at the outset. So if it's small, and in particular small, and the requirements are fuzzy, prototyping is an excellent example, an excellent choice. Now, there are some situations where the project is large, it's complicated, and certain aspects of the project are fuzzy, are unclear. Feel free to combine methods. For example, you could have the waterfall method to provide structure and discipline for the large project. But those aspects of the project that are unclear, you could use, whether it's extreme programming or prototyping or phased approach, you could use those to tease out the fuzzy nature of those particular requirements. The last thing I want to talk about has to do with what are some of the project team roles and skills. Well, for those of you who may be pursuing a career in the systems analysis and design area, there are several options available to you. You could be a business analyst. A business analyst is one who understands the business but are not as technically savvy as a systems analyst. The systems analyst is a more technically savvy, more technically inclined person. And this course is designed for the systems analyst who knows things like UML. They're able to create activity diagrams, use case diagrams, behavioral diagrams. They know how to use Visio. They may know how to program. These kinds of skills are consistent with a system analyst. Then you have an infrastructure analyst, the people who actually develop the information systems infrastructure, so they deal with networking and networking equipment and stuff like that. Then you have the project manager, of course. That's kind of self-explanatory, and some of you in the class might be project managers. You also have people who are known as change management analysts. When you have a large system development, you're actually bringing about change, and so sometimes you need people to manage the change process to give the project a chance of success. Sometimes without change management, projects are doomed to failure. Okay, this pretty much completes chapter 1. So basically, what you should know from this chapter is, for example, what is the system development life cycle? It should be clear to you that the SDLC is really not a single life cycle, but several life cycles, each of which goes through 4 major steps: planning, analysis, design, and implementation. So whether you're using the waterfall method or whether you're using prototyping, you still have to plan, you still have to analyze, design, and implement. The question really is, how much time do you spend in each of the phases? In the waterfall method, we spend a considerable amount of time in all 4 phases. But in extreme programming, we spend very little time in planning, analysis, and design, and we spend a lot of time in implementation, where we develop and test the system. Again, each method has strengths and weaknesses, and you need to be aware of those strengths and weaknesses so that when you have to choose a particular method, you would make a good choice. You also need to be aware of what is involved in each of the 4 steps. So in the planning phase, what is involved? In the analysis phase, what is involved? In the design phase, what is involved? You need to be familiar with what occurs in each of the 4 stages, then you also need to be aware of what are the advantages and disadvantages of each method. This concludes chapter 1.